League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
And there are cars all over the road, on ball with Carlos Sainz, left, right and centre. Are they going to get through? There was a car off the road there, very close to the barrier. And that's a huge crash. A huge crash in the background there. And they will have to very quickly get on site. A massive crash at the start of the race. And the race is understandably neutralised. Red flag right now. And we will hope that someone gets to Romain Grosjean very quickly there, because that looked a very scary accident indeed.
It's F1 Nation. I'm Alex Jakes. He's Tom Clarkson. And TC, I have read about accidents like that, but I've never seen one like that in modern times in HD. Truly extraordinary scenes during the Bahrain Grand Prix.
Alex, we're recording this 24 hours after the event, and I'm still struggling to comprehend what we saw in the Bahrain Grand Prix. I mean, just terrifying scenes. And for me, the difference was the fire.
Yeah.
We thought fire was a thing of the past. All the safety cells and the position of the fuel tank in the car and all of the safety measures surrounding fuel mean that we haven't had a fire like that. I can't think, I mean, since Berger at Imola 1989. And it was terrifying. That is what made it terrifying. I feel that we've had accidents of a similar violence that have been shown on TV. And I point you to Robert Kubica's crash in Montreal 2007, Alan McNish punching a wall in the outside barrier during qualifying for the Japanese Grand Prix 2002. So in terms of violence of an impact, we've seen that. But it was the fire that stood out. And that is still such a fresh and shocking image. I mean, just listening to your comms there, it must have been, was it hard to find the words to describe what was going on?
I think on the initial view that you'd seen a fireball on impact, you knew immediately it was incredibly serious. You knew immediately that it could be fatal. I don't think anyone believed that we would see an accident with that much fire in modern times. And the incredible thing to me is that Romain Grosjean cheated death by going through an Armco barrier. And I've read what happened to drivers in the 70s who went through Armco barriers without the halo. And it is really difficult to read about the aftermath of those accidents, because they were fatal and they were gruesome. He's cheated death there. And then the fire, the extraordinary response to that, we'll never see a greater escape in Formula One than that, I believe, because obviously now steps will be taken and have to be taken to make sure we never see anything like that ever again.
And what is so shocking is that the halo was only introduced 3 years ago. 36 months ago, Romain Grosjean would have been killed in that accident. And that I'm struggling to get my head around. And to think that he hasn't got a single fracture. There was the initial thought that he'd broken some ribs. He hasn't broken a single bone in his body. He's got some burns to his ankles, to the back of his hands, but he got away incredibly lightly. And amazing scenes that, as you can tell, dear listeners, I'm still struggling to get my head around. But thank goodness he's okay. You know, there's even talk that he might be back for Abu Dhabi.
That would be incredible if he was. I can think of three drivers off the top of my head now. Charles Leclerc, who had Fernando Alonso go over the top of his Sauber and the halo helping him there. Tadasuke Makino in Formula 2, the halo saving him after contact with another car, and the car got airborne, slower speed, but still wheel around the driver's helmet. And now Romain Grosjean, the halo debate is over.
100% over. Even, you know, Max Verstappen after the race on Sunday, he was one of the most outspoken critics of the introduction of the halo. And he rightly stuck his hand up and said, I was wrong. We need no more proof that it was a welcome introduction. But in a way, the halo is just another element in a safety story that is an incredible story. When you go, it all started really, didn't it, AJ, with Ayrton Senna and Roland Ratzenberger being killed at Imola in 1994. And then there've just been a progression of introductions. And, you know, I remember the hands device,
yes,
for example, introduced in 2003. Felipe Massa was the first driver to use it in the Italian Grand Prix the previous year, 2002. And I remember chatting to Juan Pablo Montoya after winter testing early 2003. He was so outspoken about the negative effect of the hands device and how he was getting numb shoulders because you place it underneath the belts and then pull the belts tight. And he was just really struggling with it. So there's always seems to be a little bit of resistance from the drivers, but everything has counted towards the events that helped save Romain Grosjean's life. Because let's not forget, it was a 53G impact. So, wow. So that hands device absolutely played a role in keeping him safe. I mean, just thank goodness too, Alex, that he wasn't knocked unconscious in the accident. Because as it was, I think he was sat in that inferno for more than 20 seconds.
Yeah, 28 seconds, I think it was timed out.
Incredible.
Incredible. We are very grateful indeed to so many people who have made those safety improvements year after year at the FIA. People like Sid Watkins, people like Charlie Whiting, and their work has been advanced by others. It all paid off in the Bahrain Grand Prix. The progress made shown in staggering starkness with those pictures shown all the way around the world.
AJ, we should also mention Laurent Mekies,
yes,
who is now Ferrari's sporting director. He was actually acting team principal in Bahrain because Mattia Binotto stayed home in Maranello. But he was the FIA's safety delegate when the halo was being pushed through and there was resistance. And so Laurent definitely played his part in the introduction of the halo as well. And two people who were all over our TV screens, and you will have seen photos over the last 24 hours, who were instrumental in getting Grosjean to safety on Sunday evening, were the medical car driver, Alan van der Merwe, and the FIA's Dr. Ian Roberts. And I'm delighted to say, guys, that we've got you with us now. We're talking the day after. You've been to see Romain Grosjean in hospital. Dr. Ian, if we could start with you, how is he today?
Well, in very good spirits. It's very, very bright and breezy. Doing his jazz hands with the dressings. Doctors are all very, very happy with his progress, and so are we. And he's talking about coming back to racing, which I'm not surprised.
The extent of his injuries, I mean, there's no fractures, is that right? And what? How bad are the burns?
Currently, the burns are being dressed on a daily basis. He does have burns on the backs of both hands. And we were given reports as to the extent. Generally, the opinion of the specialist is that there will be a good result from healing his foot. Initially, he thought that there might have been a fracture, but that is most likely down to some sort of tissue injury.
Well, guys, great to speak to you first of all. I think you're two of the most popular people on the entire planet at the moment after your actions yesterday. I just wanted to know, was it down to practice or was it down to instinct? Because I doubt that either of you have ever faced anything quite like that in all the time that you've been involved in your roles.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we try to be very creative when we're thinking about scenarios and when we're thinking about, and this was probably a combination of most of our worst case scenarios. I think the fact that we have spoken about it helped a little bit. Preparation was probably 80% yesterday, and the other 20% was Roman somehow miraculously being able to do what he did. And Ian, with his, you know, he's been doing this most of his adult life, you know, looking after people and saving lives, kind of selflessly pushing the limits a lot further than a lot of other people have done, I think. It was incredible. I think just the whole thing was incredibly fragile, and any any one factor slightly different, we could have got there a bit slower, or the marshal that ran across the circuit wouldn't have been there in time, things like that. There were so many things that could have changed the outcome. Perfect sort of example of teamwork, preparation, and then a huge amount of luck and chance that just helped us along.
Alan, can I just ask you a bit more about that? The marshal that ran across the circuit, so...
He will have had to run a good 100, 150 metres, very heavy fire gear, and probably 12-ish kilo extinguisher, something like that. And it's not fresh here, it's pretty warm. So he had a lot of foresight to actually get there, because there were a lot of his colleagues that were actually on the other side of the barrier already. But he had a huge amount of value there, able to create this tiny window of opportunity for Roland to jump out and get into close to help him. We're getting a lot of the attention because we have a platform, but he's actually very key in this whole thing.
Ian, the accident was on your side of the car, so I'm guessing that as you opened the door, you had the best view. Can you just describe how you processed what you were seeing?
As we arrived, there's a disconnect. In a lot of these major incidents, there is a disconnect about what you see and what you think you should be seeing. That was here. In front of us, just to the right, there was the back of the car pointing in the wrong direction. And the question was, I won't use the words that we used, where's the rest? Where's the driver? And I looked to my right, and that's where the fire was. And there was a gap in the barrier, and I could see Roman and the rest of the car behind there. As I've described it before to people, it was like looking at the open door of a furnace. He was there, he was moving, but there was just a red sheet of flame in front of him all around.
So you could see him moving straight away?
Yes. And in fact, we both seen the on-car footage, and he almost doesn't miss a beat. As soon as the impact is done and he's come to rest, he's getting himself going, which is absolutely incredible. I mean, 53G recorded on the ADR, and he was still conscious, and he wanted to get out of there. And you can see that on the video. It's quite upsetting to watch, but his want for life was pretty much evident in that.
You've been a helicopter first responder for much of your professional life. How did that help you yesterday in Bahrain?
Probably not so much that. I mean, most of my work has been in intensive care. My hobby, as it were, is trackside medical work for motorsport. And over the years, I have seen a number of incidents that this one certainly puts everything else into the shade. What you've done before, what experience you have, but then you still have to be a little bit creative, because most of the things that we go to are out of the ordinary. They're beyond what you would normally see. The energies that get dissipated by these hugely powerful cars sometimes just really does overtake science and engineering to hold back.
Guys, can I take a step back and ask you why you both wanted the jobs in the first place? It's a role where you hope you're not needed very much during a weekend. You put a lot of practice in, but you ultimately hope that after lap number one, that's your Sunday completed.
To be very painfully honest, I didn't want this job. rather been driving around in circles, the other guys.
Well, Alan, let's not forget, I mean, for people who don't know, you know, British Formula 3 champion, a few years back, yeah, was it 2003?
No, it's very unexpected, but it was just an opportunity. Charlie offered me the opportunity in a very casual way 12, 13 years ago now. And at the time, I didn't really see how it would be a valuable experience for me over such a long period. I thought it would be interesting, but I never thought it would be what it's turned out to be for me. And it's interesting how pretty much anything you do, you can make it into a challenge, and you can try and find ways to improve it, and you can work with really impressive people and some not so impressive people, and it's challenging in so many different ways. It's not what I'm used to, but I still find it very enjoyable. I don't get adrenaline on the first lap in the morning. I don't, the the lights go out. I used to. When I started, I think I looked like I was like a trained dog when the red lights went on. I don't really get that anymore. And even yesterday, you know, you don't feel stressed. I think obviously there is a huge element of stress, but we feel semi-prepared and we feel responsible. You know, we feel responsible to do what we can because we know we're sort of the last, or a bit of an insurance policy. But yeah, it's a very unique thing to be doing. I never thought I would be doing it. I never thought I'd be working with someone like you. It's very interesting.
Yeah, from my side of things, I was merrily working away in the UK at Silverstone as the chief medical officer there, doing the different bits of motorsport. And I got the phone call out of the blue. The FIA were looking for a medical rescue coordinator. I must admit, it took me about 10 seconds to think about it and say yes. And I've enjoyed my time. Since your question about the first lap and then not doing anything, I would absolutely love every weekend to do the first lap and just sit there and watch the racing. And so, you know, some nice exciting racing, nobody gets hurt, and everybody has a great time. So I don't want to do anything.
Miraculous escape for Roman. I think we all agree on that, but lessons can always be learned. What is the process now in terms of what happens next to try and improve safety, and what are the primary lessons that we've learned, or is it too early to say yet?
I think there are some early lessons. In fact, we started discussing this over breakfast this morning about, you know, are there any little incremental things that we can do to make anything even remotely like this happens again, what are the tweaks that we have? What equipment things can we do in the medical car? On a more major scale, obviously there's going to be an investigation to the incident. The FIA safety department will look at it in great detail. They will be extremely interested in all aspects of the incident, right from the halo, right the way through to clothing, what improvements can be made there. I think we've been asked several times about what we feel about the halo. Was it instrumental? Well, I think, you know, all of the elements that have been on the car have been instrumental in a favourable outcome to the incident. The true value of all of this will be brought out in the subsequent investigation and improvements made where necessary.
Alan, you spoke quite eloquently about standing on the shoulders of giants. How much of yesterday's successful outcome was due to the work done by those who have come before?
We were there for 30 seconds. There are people like Abby Miller, who you might have never heard of, rammed things into walls and bent things and cut things and did all sorts of, I don't know how many man hours went into something as simple as the halo. And then you have all of the specifications of the safety equipment. You have all of the concepts that have been developed for medical crews. You have the way the cars have been run by AMG. It's unimaginable the amount of effort, the amount of hours that have gone into this. And we turn up and we're the most visible part. But if any one of those things wasn't in place, if Charlie wouldn't have pushed a lot of things like the halo, it could have been a very, very different outcome. So I think, yeah, it's great to feel like we did a good job and things went well. But you know, without all of that stuff that's happened, you know, since the 70s, it's been a huge, huge improvement in survivability. You know, without all of that, we would have lost yesterday. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
And Alan, does the racing driver in you understand why Romain Grosjean wants to get back in the car in 10 days' time for Abu Dhabi?
100%. I completely get that. I think there's no way you'd be in Formula One. You have to be semi-obsessive to sort of be at this level. I completely understand.
Guys, many thanks for your time. Great to speak.
We had a very unusual start. And after that, Lewis Hamilton won. A very typical finish. Lewis Hamilton's 95th Grand Prix victory. His 11th win of the year. Frankly, ridiculous stuff. If you look at on pure pace, he could have won all but one of the Grand Prix this year without penalties.
11 out of 15 races. I mean, extraordinary record.
The big story, though, for the remaining races of the year, the battle for third place in the Constructors' Championship.
So, Alex, it's McLaren, Racing Point, Renault in that order. I think Ferrari are now out of the battle, and I think they're going to struggle because it's a horsepower track coming up in Sakhir. So it's between those three, this battle for. Now, who do you think deserves P3?
That is an interesting question. We always have a graphic at the start of the weekend that we show on F1 TV, which is the progress that all the cars have made since the very first round of the year in Austria. And you have to say, McLaren are getting an awful lot from a car that doesn't appear to be as quick or has been developed as much compared to the Racing Point and the Renault. They're squeezing every drop out of the championship. I have to say, after the race, my predominant feeling is McLaren are going to mug Renault and Racing Point, and they are going to find a cunning way to third place in this championship because they are getting results when the car seemingly isn't capable. The team and drivers are making the difference. But with Lando Norris, Carlos Sainz, and a brilliantly run team, they're third.
Operationally brilliant. There have been a couple of sketchy pit stops along the way, and you know, perhaps Lando Norris might have finished on the podium in the Eiffel Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, but they really have maximized their opportunities. And I think I agree with you. I think they deserve it. I think Renault have done a really good job in terms of how they've stepped up this year. Whereas, and I think the team with the fastest car, Racing Point, have just let it slip through their fingers. Yes, unfortunate reliability, of course, on Sunday in Bahrain. But then, you know, you look back to Imola and that decision to pit Sergio Perez in the dying moments of that race, whereas Daniel Ricciardo stayed out and mugged him for the podium. So in terms of merit, I think it's McLaren from Renault from Racing Point. There you go. Do you agree with me, AJ?
I think Renault were always going to struggle to get P3 from the moment that you tipped them to finish in that position for the Russian Grand Prix. I think
Thank you very much. I knew you'd remind me of that.
The curse of TC has hit strong.
You're not going to commit either way, are you, big man?
No, I'm not. What I'm going to do is introduce our next guest in this packed podcast. The man who's played a pivotal role in McLaren climbing back up that Constructors' Championship is James Key. And TC caught up with the McLaren technical director earlier in the week.
Shall we kick off by talking about this battle for P3 in the Constructors' Championship? How much is that dominating your thoughts at the minute?
It's obviously very high on our list of priorities as it stands. It's extremely tight. It could go either way. The competition's very strong. So whilst we've got a 21 car with a new engine to finish off and a 22 car to to carry on with, I think the big priority right now is to see through these last three races in what's been a very, very compact season. So it's all happening very quickly.
Now, who's got the fastest car?
It's a very good question. I think Racing Point have been kind of leading that charge, to be honest, because they have had very, very good speed as the season's progressed. But equally, it's close enough to make it very difficult to tell, because I think as you go to one track to another, you tend to see various teams emerge as slightly quicker. And we know that a tenth can make a massive difference now in qualifying. So I think we're seeing a real variability there from one track to the next, the nature of the circuit, the way the tyres are working for you and so on. And that's really, I suppose, why it's so close now. You can't guarantee where you're going to be on a Saturday afternoon right now with qualifying.
Okay, James, and who operationally has done the best job so far, do you think?
To be honest, I'm not blowing McLaren's trumpet directly here. I think we've done extremely well, really, this season, just because we've been consistent. Both drivers have performed very well. They're very close. We've often got both cars in, or more often than not, actually, both cars in Q3. I think, but generally, reliability has been strong on the chassis side. So I think operationally, we've done pretty well. Having said that, we're up against teams which equally have done exceptional job. We've had our fair share of bad luck. You know, the first lap in Russia, the tyre in Silverstone, the engine issues that we've had in Spa and Nürburgring. So we've had our issues, but I think when it comes to just purely going racing, we have got it together well at the track, I think.
And with so much at stake, how much does the Sakhir Grand Prix worry you guys? The sort of the threat of the unknown, or does that simply excite you?
It's a great challenge to have. I think as racers, we like this tight competition. You know, the stress levels are obviously high every time you face the next event. But I think we welcome the challenge. It's nice to be in that race. Like I say, it could go either way. It's so close, and I don't think it frightens us at all. I think we're up for it. We know we have the car and the drivers and the team to challenge for that P3. And I think the events coming up, you know, Abu Dhabi is a pretty technical track, and we'll have to see there. But I think the Bahrain circuit sort of suits our car. And
what about the outer loop, or what? I don't even know what we're meant to call it now. But does the threat? Do you see the sort of the potential for jeopardy there as a threat? Or, I mean, you, as an engineer, you would much rather go to a track you know or not?
I think it represents an opportunity. It's a bit like a new sort of technical regulations. You know, it represents an opportunity in that there's something new to learn there. And it's about preparation. It's about understanding that new circuit, doing all the work up front. So there is, of course, a threat there in that things can go wrong, but it can go wrong for anyone. Equally, I think things like traffic management, this is going to be a very, very short lap at that track. How's that going to work? That's an operational aspect. So there's lots of challenges there, lots of threats, if you will. But I think it also, as an optimist and as an optimistic team, I think we see it as an opportunity more than a threat.
Can we talk drivers now? Lando. How's he improved in year two, do you feel?
He had a great year one, and to improve on that is pretty impressive in its own right. But I think what we're seeing in Lando now is someone who is really probably more confident in himself, probably has higher expectations of what he can achieve now, and rightly so. And is you know, with that sort of maturity and experience that you naturally build up after having experienced a year, and then albeit a slightly different type of season this year, nonetheless, just building on that, I think we're seeing a more rounded driver. But he had a good year last year as well, so it's really enhancing what he was doing before, I suppose.
When you say more confident in terms of what he wants from a car.
Yeah, I think both. I think the technical side of things, he's just more accustomed to that. It's, you know, these cars are very technical. All the engine modes, all the setup options, the way the tires behave, they all take a bit of learning. And I think he has, you know, taken on board what he learned last year, and he learned extremely quickly last year, I have to say, and just melded that into a technical confidence where he feels that, you know, the feedback he can give, the decisions he can make, the way he can interact with engineers are just a step up, but also confidence in himself as well, you know, knowing that he can do it rather than being concerned about what may or may not happen one race to the next.
What's been his most impressive race? Dare we say Austria? Austria won and...
I was going to say Austria.
He hit the ground running.
He did. He had two good races, actually, but the Austria... One was, I mean, none of us knew where we were. We'd had this winter testing. It was then the middle of the year, a different time of year than you'd normally go to some of these circuits as well. So he's had a lot of good races, but Austria does stand out. You know, it's the beginning of the season. We all had to find out what was going on, and to get a podium in that first race was fantastic.
And how big a hole is Carlos Sainz going to leave behind?
He definitely leaves a hole because he's done a great job for us. And I think... He's, you know, I've known Carlos for some time now. I worked with him at my previous team as well, and he's an excellent driver to work with. He's very kind of solid, very mature. He always delivers, even when we're up against it, just as he did actually last weekend at Turkey. And I think we will miss that. You know, there's a good relationship and rhetoric within the team with him and Lando. That continuity you miss a bit as well. But, so that will leave a gap. That will leave something that we've become accustomed to over the past couple of years. But his replacement, I think, will fill it extremely well. I think it's great to have Dan on board. And I think having worked with him also in the past, I know he'll bring, you know, new and different opinions and ways of working to the team, which would be welcome. So there's a gap to fill, but we've got a great guy to fill it.
I've forgotten that you've worked with Daniel at Toro Rosso. Of course you had. What is his strongest asset?
Carlos.
No, we're on Daniel now. Carlos is nothing to us anymore, James. We've moved on.
Well, I genuinely wish Carlos the best of luck in his endeavours with Ferrari. I'm sure he'll do well. I think for Daniel, you know, he's a race winner. You know, he'll bring great experience. He'll bring, you know, a lighter sort of jovial touch in some cases as well. We know he's a great character out of the car as well as in, but he'll bring a great deal of experience and a huge amount of determination. I think what always impressed me with Daniel is this massive amount of determination he has, particularly when he's driving. You can really feel and see that. You listen to his radio messages and when he's driving, it's a very different sort of character really to when he's out in the car and more relaxed. He's incredibly determined when he's racing. And I think that with his experience and his confidence, knowing what he can do, now he's a genuine, well-established race winner. I think all of that will bring good confidence to the team and a slightly different kind of aspect to how we see certain things with the car technically as well. He'll bring, you know, good knowledge in for that.
As you say, he's a race winner. Do you think he's top draw? Is he right up there with the Max Verstappens, the Charles Leclercs? Is he part of that top echelon, if you like?
Yes, I think he is. I mean, look, you know, what is the top echelon? I think so much is dependent on factors at the moment with cars and so on. But you know, as an established race winner, yes, he is. I think you know he can compete at those levels, and we've seen him do it in past years. So I think he's one of those drivers who could step into any of the top teams and do well. We would obviously like to become a top team ourselves, and I think with his help we can make more progress in that direction. But yeah, I think we all rate him extremely highly.
Brilliant. Well, finally, the motor that Daniel and Lando are going to be driving next year. How far down the road are you with it?
So we're in reasonable shape. I think we're where we'd expect to be at this time of year, despite the obvious delays we had earlier in the year. Normally you'd want to start earlier than we did. We obviously didn't start as early as we'd like to have done for obvious reasons, but I think we caught up well. The interaction with Mercedes has been fantastic. They've been extremely supportive, recognised the fact that we had short time scales, and we've worked with them very effectively over the past few months. And I think we're about where we'd expect to be with the maturity of the engine installation and the parts that we're already making for 21.
When did you first receive the Mercedes power unit?
I'm trying to think back now, because we had this long shutdown period, of course, earlier in the year. We started talking to them before then, so we had kind of upfront information and knowledge as to where they were headed for 21 with their engine, and some of the important basics like the types of cooling requirement we would have, the implications on car layout with things like the you know, the energy store dimensions and this sort of thing, which are all pretty fundamental questions. Some about the electrical installation as well. So we had that sort of baseline fundamental information up and running prior to Melbourne, you'd say, because that's really when we stopped racing for a while. And then since then, we've gone into more and more detail as they've continued to develop the 21 power unit. And there's still little bits and pieces that to be finalised there, but the majority, the bulk of the information is complete. And, you know, we talk to them weekly, you know, regularly, actually, just as you would. So we're fairly well sorted with the information we need. I think the difference, though, is that homologation and cost caps, etc., aside, which has an impact on this as well, it's just the timing. You'd normally want to be working through spring and into summer with all of that information there, and then be optimizing as you get into autumn, whereas really we started off in the summer, and we're going to be sort of optimizing very late into now, actually, and into the new year.
And from a downforce point of view, how much have you been able to claw back with the changes to the floor, for example?
Yeah, so that's still work in progress. We've had, obviously, this project's been going for a while, although the regulations, the total regulations for the aero changes for 21 were quite late. Yes, we're clawing it back. You know, it was a reasonably big hit to begin with. Those floor changes on the side profile of the floor, which would be quite obvious when we see 21 cars, small mods to the diffuser and the rear brake ducts. So they all kind of influence a very complex area of aerodynamics around the rear tire. And really, it's a case of trying to pull that back as best we can. And we are, you know, we're making progress every week on that at the moment, but there's still some work to do.
Great to hear from James Key there. And TC, what struck me about that is how McLaren have so many challenges. They've got an extra challenge compared to the rest of the field, haven't they? They've got to get that Mercedes power unit in the back of the car. They've got to use development tokens to do so. And then they've got the massive challenge of 2022 as well.
You're right there. But if there's one team that's used to changing power supplier, it is them. Because remember, in this hybrid era, 2014, they had a Mercedes. 2015, they swapped to Honda. Then they went to Renault. And now they're going back to Mercedes. So they've had it all going on, quite frankly, over the last 7 years. And so they're well positioned to do it. James Key, I'm really excited about seeing what he can do with a Mercedes power unit. And let's not forget, going back to what we were saying prior to hearing from James, that McLaren have maximized their opportunities with a Renault engine. It's not like they've had a Mercedes in the back this year. They've had a Renault, which is not as good a power unit as Mercedes. And of course, Racing Point have had a Mercedes. So they've done a cracking job, and I'm sure they'll continue to do so.
Well, looking ahead to Sakhir, and we're going to have a Fittipaldi on the Formula One grid once again.
Such a fast name.
It really is.
I'm sure Pietro's fast, because, you know, there are great racing driver names, and Fittipaldi is just, I mean, it conjures up so many memories and a lot of emotion. And talking of emotion, he's the grandson of double world champion Emerson, and Emerson is such an emotional person anyway. I'm sure he will be living the dream when he sees Pietro lining up on the grid on Sunday. I'll be honest with you, Alex, I know he's tested for them a bit, but I don't know much about his junior career. Are you more of an expert than me?
Well, I can tell you that he had a horrible accident of his own, breaking both legs in a crash in the World Endurance Championship at Spa. Really scary accident for him.
Oh, I think I've seen footage of that on social media. Yeah. Did it flip?
Yeah, he flips and broke both legs, and he's had to recover from that. That was in 2018. So he's been a little bit around the houses. He's done a little bit of IndyCar. He's done a little bit of DTM. He is a really nice guy. The team love working with him. And it's great to see another driver get a chance. I feel a little bit sorry for Louis Delatraz on the F2 grid, who's done amazing development work. He's done so many hours in the simulator, but that's what happens if you have two reserve drivers. One person is going to miss out. But given the fact that we're almost certainly having a Schumacher in the Haas next year, somehow Pietro Fittipaldi, he's won the racing surname battle, and he'll be on the grid first. It will be a big moment for Brazil, of course, because they've not had a Formula One driver for a while.
Well, you could say difficult, you could say easy, in terms of, I think it's going to be a difficult weekend for the Ferrari-powered cars, yeah, at Sakhir, because obviously the layout that we're negotiating next weekend is just all about speed and power, and so they're going to be on the back foot, but that maybe takes the pressure off him a little bit, just to sort of get used to it all. And it'd be great to see what he can do. I mean, Kevin Magnussen is such a nice guy, such a generous guy, that I'm sure he'll give him all the support he needs.
Well, that's just about all we've got time for on this week's F1 Nation. Thank you to Alan van der Merwe, to Dr. Ian Roberts, to James Key, to Tom Clarkson, to you for listening, and to everyone who helped push safety forward so that Romain Grosjean could step away from that fireball. Get well soon, Romain. Thank you for listening. Subscribe and leave a review if you fancy it, really, at this stage of the season. Who cares? Great to have your company, though. Appreciate it. That's F1 Nation this week. We will speak to you next.
We Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.